Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Wow!
Hey, welcome back. Some news going on right now in Russia. There's a bomber base about 150 miles, that's all, from Moscow that got hit by, they're not sure whether it's missiles or drones, presumably by Ukraine. I mean, that means that Ukraine is projecting power into Russia now, which is astonishing. And of course, NATO and the U.S. and our armaments are certainly involved, no doubt about it. But this is a new phase in what's been going on. And however it's being done, Ukraine is bringing the battle to Russia, to the doorstep of the Kremlin. 150 miles is not very far. And that's unfolding right now. Apparently, one or two of their bombers, the strategic big bombers, have been destroyed. And we'll see what happens. We don't know exactly what that means, but that's something that's unfolding right now. Also, I wanted to bring to your attention, and this is some good news here, the Biden administration has waived a Supreme Court review in a key transgender fight. This is from Real Clear Policy. For the last 6 years, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services has pushed a controversial transgender mandate, which threatens religious doctors and hospitals with multi-million dollar penalties unless they perform gender transition surgeries in violation of their conscience and medical judgment. When the doctors fought back, winning a major victory in federal appeals court in August, the fight appeared to be poised to head to the Supreme Court. Now, I shared that story with you last week, a little bit of victory there. But, and this is the more victory part, on Friday of last week, the Biden administration gave up on seeking a Supreme Court review, meaning that the hard-fought victory for religious liberty now stands as a powerful precedent nationwide. The case called Franciscan Alliance versus Becerra was brought by a Catholic hospital system and the Christian Medical and Dental Associations, a nationwide organization of thousands of Christian healthcare professionals. The plaintiffs, motivated by their religious mission, compassionately treat every patient who walks through their doors for everything from cancer to the common cold. But like many other healthcare professionals and experts, they view medical interventions designed to change a person's gender to be harmful, which it is. Contrary both to the best medical data about how to treat individuals struggling with gender dysphoria and to their religious understanding of sexuality in the human person, they therefore decline to perform such procedures, and they won't cover them on their insurance plans. However, in 2016, the federal government attempted to force them to do that. That year, in the waning days of the Obama administration, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services issued a rule interpreting the Affordable Care Act's ban on quote-unquote sex discrimination in healthcare to mean that healthcare professionals must perform and ensure gender transitions or else face crippling penalties. Over the intervening years and administrations, the mandate has been tweaked around the edges, but the basic requirement, i.e. to perform gender transitions or else get out of medicine, has remained the same, with the Biden administration most recently declaring that it is dangerous, and they're going to try to attempt to restrict gender transition procedures, even for minors. No, they're saying it's dangerous if you try to restrict gender transition procedures. It's only dangerous for their ideology, that's all. Anyway, so long story short, there's more to the article if you want to read it. They gave up, at least in terms of trying to fight this all the way up to the Supreme Court. They gave up. I don't know if they're going to come back, but at least for the time being, that's a victory. If you want to read the whole thing, you'll find it on the show Twitter feed, at P. Madrid Show. Let's go to Denise now in St. John, Indiana. Hi, Denise.
Hi, Patrick. I need your help again. I lost two brothers way too soon. Both were cremated, and my one brother was divorced, and his children wanted the ashes split because he was a veteran. He's at our military cemetery out here. And they took the rest of the ashes and put them in a white Sox urn, which is in my family room with a picture of him. Mm-hmm. And my sister-in-law from the other brother, she separated the ashes so that each child could, well, my nephew has a crucifix with his ashes, and the girls and she have an actual thumbprint that the funeral home, you know, did for him, and then his ashes are in there. You know, I've listened to you on this before, but I didn't know about this, not spreading. We would never spread, but splitting up, is that also a bad thing?
Well, here's the thing. And by the way, my condolences to you and your family. So I'm sorry that that you're dealing. Is it a are these recent deaths?
No, but they may as well be. One was brain cancer in 2009. And then my mother 8 months later, my dad 11 months later, and then 6 years ago, my other brother in an accidental death. And yeah, it's been very rough, very rough.
I'm so sorry. And what sorrow in your family. Well, let me share with you what the U.S. Bishops Conference website says on this issue. So this is, and we'll get a link posted to this for you. First thing I should point out is the church does not promote or encourage cremation. And prior to, I think it was in the 90s, the church did not even allow it. It was not permitted for Catholics to be cremated. So this is by way of concession that the church has relaxed its prior restriction and now permits it but doesn't encourage it. And the whole idea of destroying the body, in my view at least, is abhorrent. But in any case, the point is that the church does permit it. And so in its instruction, here's what the bishops say. The practice of cremation has grown and become more commonplace in the United States and is often presented as a more affordable alternative to traditional burial. What is often overlooked is the church's teaching regarding the respect and honor due to the human body. The Order of Christian Funerals appendix on cremation states, although cremation is now permitted by the church, it does not enjoy the same value as burial of the body. The church clearly prefers and urges that the body of the deceased be present for the funeral rites, since the presence of the human body better expresses the values which the church affirms in those rites. Ideally, if a family chooses cremation, the cremation would take place at some time after the funeral mass so that there can be an opportunity for the vigil for the deceased in the presence of the body, a visitation or viewing, etc. This allows for the appropriate reverence for the sacredness of the body at the funeral mass, sprinkling with holy water, the placing of the pall, and honoring it with incense. The rite of committal then takes place after cremation. And that's referring to the interment of the remains, either into a columbarium or a mausoleum, that kind of thing. And it says, then there's one particular part I'd like to just focus on here. The cremated remains of a body should be treated with the same respect given to the human body from which they come. This includes the use of a worthy vessel to contain the ashes, the manner in which they are carried, and the care and attention to appropriate placement and transport in the final disposition. The cremated remains should be buried in a grave or entombed in a mausoleum or columbarium. The practice of scattering cremated remains on the sea, from the air, or on the ground, or keeping cremated remains in the home of a relative or a friend of the deceased, these are not reverent dispositions that the church requires. So there's more, but that sort of gets to the heart of the issue. The church says, don't do that. Take the remains, bring them to a Catholic cemetery if possible. A mausoleum or a columbarium typically would be there, and inter them there. And that's the appropriate way to get the final resting place for these remains. So many Catholics don't know that. So this is a reason why every so often it's worthwhile to kind of read that so people understand what the church is asking of them.
And so even like with these necklaces and crucifixes with tiny ashes in it, shouldn't have been done then, huh?
No.
Mm-mm. Okay.
Now, well, if you did it in true ignorance, that's one thing. You know, some people say, I don't care what the church says. I'm going to do what I want to do. That's a problem. But it doesn't sound like that's what's going on here.
No, and the only thing is, now the children of my brother with this White Sox urn, my dad wanted, because my brother had already passed when my dad did, he wanted him buried with him at the military cemetery because they both served. Mm-hmm. And the kids said, no, we want him with us. That's why we did it. So now I'm going to probably have to present this to them and see what they say then. But it's a very, very touchy thing because they find comfort. And the only reason I have it is because they have large dogs and they didn't want the dogs, you know, anywhere near this. So, but at least I know what I can present to them and see what they say. So I really, really appreciate your help.
You're welcome. And I realize it's a touchy, delicate situation. People's emotions are invested in this. I understand that. And I respect that. I really do. I just want to share what the church says about this, because I think a lot of Catholics, they just never really have heard it before. So it's new to them.
Well, I know none of them have, because if I haven't, the only time I heard it was from you when I didn't have the other questions that I wanted to ask you. So I thank you so much again.
You're welcome. You're welcome, Denise. Good chatting with you. And again, my condolences. Now, for you, Denise, or anyone else listening, if you want the actual verbiage that I was quoting selections from, you want to hear it directly from the horse's mouth, so to speak, you can get this link to the Catholic Bishops Conference statement on this issue. Just go, if you're on Twitter, just go to @PMadridShow. Might as well follow us while you're there. And you can also get it by going to the show page, relevantradio.com/Patrick, and you'll see it embedded on the lower right there and worth sharing with your friends and family. Let's go now to Dusty in Bountiful, Utah. Hi, Dusty.
Hi, Patrick. I'm learning about Catholicism right now, and I'm currently an agnostic, and I used to be a Mormon. And my question is, where Mormons talk about praying and receiving a burning in the bosom to know if their church is true, I'm wondering with the Catholic faith, what is the process that someone looking into the church, what is the Catholic process of discerning if the church is true? Does that make sense?
It does, yeah. And I'm happy to hear that you're on that journey. So first thing I'll tell you, Dusty, is I'm here for you. Relevant Radio is here for you 24/7. So if you would like to stay plugged in as you are on this journey and you're exploring and thinking about things, let us help you in things like this, answering questions and whatnot.
Thank you.
The process is typically something like this. What would happen is if you... And as you feel drawn and you become more and more interested and hopefully as time goes by, more and more convinced, then you would, and you could do this at any time, you could do it now if you wanted to, you could begin visiting a Catholic parish and start the process of, you know, going to Mass and seeing what happens at Mass. Don't go to receive communion, because that's for once you've become Catholic. But in the meantime, you could, in essence, soak in it. You can watch and listen and see what happens at Mass. Very, very different, by the way, from what you would see, for example, at a stake center on Sunday.
Yes.
And maybe you've already seen this, but you will see it in due time. Read. I would recommend, there's a book that I edited. It's called Surprised by Truth. And it is the story of converts. In this case, they were all Protestant and became Catholic. And there's some later editions of the Surprised by Truth books that have at least one or two who came from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormon Church. So you might find that interesting. There's a brand new book out, actually, by an author. And I'm going to have to find the name, and I'll maybe at this next break, I will be happy to share that book title with you. And he was a former LDS member and came into the church, and he tells his story. But the process would go something like this. When you reach the point where you say, I really want to find out for sure if I'm going to be Catholic, then you would enroll in what's called RCIA. And that stands for Rite of Christian Initiation of Adults. And what that would entail would be at your local parish, and you're free to choose different parishes. I mean, there's some unevenness in terms of some parishes being a little more devout than others or a little more traditional than others. But I have one other thing I'll recommend to you in a minute, Dusty. But when you enroll in that, you're under no obligation. You don't have to pay any money. You're just there to find out if you would like to become Catholic. And then as you progress and you say, yes, I do, then you would become a catechumen, and you would be formally now in the process of entering into the church. And that process usually takes about a year. It doesn't have to, but it typically takes about a year. And usually the people who come into the church would come in on the Easter Vigil Mass, so Holy Saturday night, early in the morning on Easter Sunday. Now, if you were baptized in the LDS Church and had never mm-hmm. been baptized anywhere else, yes. you would get baptized as a Catholic, because the Catholic Church does not accept Mormon baptism as valid. So you right. would receive baptism, you would receive confirmation, you would receive the Holy Eucharist, you would make a profession of faith, and then you would be fully fledged Catholic. That's okay. how it would end up.
Okay. Wow. That's very interesting, the contrast, because it doesn't seem like there's anything as simple as just praying about it and getting kind of a feeling. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yeah, that's actually the part that I didn't get to. And
oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, no, it's okay. It's okay. It's just that I wanted to give you that one component there in terms of like, yeah. what does the process look like? But all along the way, mm-hmm. your prayers, your studies, your insights, your talking to Catholic folk, what you see, what you experience, that's definitely at the heart of this. So it's not just, you know, intellectual certitude. There's also the gift of faith, which is a supernatural virtue. Now, what's different here is that Mormons, they invest a great deal of weight in their testimony, and they say that they feel the burning in the bosom, and they testify that their Savior lives, and they testify that they know that Joseph Smith is a true prophet of God, and they testify. Well,
yes.
that's purely subjective, and it doesn't yes. really mean any, it doesn't prove anything. It's a yes. kind of way of reinforcing how you feel. And you remember the testimony Sundays at Mass?
Yes.
that's a way of trying to bolster everybody's testimony by telling everybody how much they testify to these things. So
yes.
my thought on this issue, Dusty, is it's nice when you have feelings or twinges of spiritual nature. Sometimes it happens, sometimes it doesn't. But even if you don't feel that kind of tingling or burning in the bosom, it in no way would mean that something is true or not true. You would evaluate yes. it on the merits of, you know, what did Jesus say and do. Those articles that I mentioned that I wrote on this issue are available for free. You might want to get them. Just go to relevantradio.com/Patrick and click under links and then click on articles. And there's quite a bit there. And maybe three or four of them have to deal with Catholic LDS issues, but that's free, and yes. that would be something you could take a look at.
Okay. Okay, great. And do you think, Patrick, in all your experience of doing what you do, that it might be particularly difficult for me being an agnostic versus like a Protestant or somebody converting to Catholicism? Is that less likely in your experience? Does that question make sense?
It does. Yeah, it makes complete sense. And no, I don't think that there's any greater barrier for you. It's just a different kind of barrier. And
yeah.
and so if you're struggling and wondering, does God exist? And if so, mm-hmm. how can I know that? There are ways to help with that. So I would recommend, if you're interested in reading, I would recommend books by Dr. Edward Faeser, F-E-S-E-R. He's a professor of philosophy at Pasadena City College in Southern California. Maybe one book you might want to take a look at is called The Last Superstition. Now, it's a critique of atheism. So if you want to look at it from that standpoint, I co-authored a book with Ken Hensley called The Godless Delusion. And it's yeah. not an attack on atheists at all. It's just a critique mm-hmm. of the atheist worldview. That might be something to take a look at.
Oh, great. Thank you so much, Patrick. I really appreciate what you do. You're great. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Dusty. Now, before you go, one final thing, and that is there's a great organization in Utah called CatholicUtah.org, and my advice would be this. Remember I mentioned about some parishes are not as maybe robust in their faith and they're in being more traditional than others. If you yes. get in touch with the people at CatholicUtah.org, ask them for some advice for a good parish in your area. Now, I've been to Bountiful before, and I've gone to Mass in Bountiful, but I don't remember the name of the parish. I don't know if it might have been St. Olaf's, but that might be in Salt Lake City.
Yes, I think that is the one in Bountiful. I actually looked that up. Yeah, okay. I think you're right.
Yeah, well, I had good experiences there in the times that I was there. But my main thing is that if you get in touch with the people at CatholicUtah.org, they'll be happy to give you suggestions, recommendations. Maybe there's some priests that they know that would be happy to hear from you and answer questions. So that's another little inside, you know, connection that you'll have with them.
Okay. Okay, great. I appreciate that. I wrote all that down. Thank you so much, Patrick.
You're welcome, Dusty. God bless you, and I hope we talk again. I really do. Man, what God does through Relevant Radio, it's beautiful. I'll be right back. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. The Catholic Order of Foresters, the sponsor of our studio lines, is hiring today. Several positions available throughout the U.S. Visit relevantradio.com/forester to learn more about how you can find your vocation with COF, an Illinois Life Insurance Society not licensed in all states.
Get connected to the conversation. Call now, 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now. Relevant Radio.
All right, time for a little levity. How did I describe this? Hey, guys, FYI, if you're going to propose to your girlfriend, don't do it around water. Like, don't propose to her where there's a waterfall or a lake or an ocean, because the likelihood of that ring going away for good is pretty high. And I have a quick story here. Is this CBS News? I think it is.
I think it's CNN.
CNN? Okay. Yeah. So just a quick, funny little thing. You need to see it because it is very funny. It almost got really not funny, and then it got funny again. So here it is.
He lured his intended to the bow to recreate that famous Titanic embrace.
We're flying!
But in this case, what went flying was the engagement ring Scott Klein pulled out of his pocket in a box. Watch it bounce off the deck. Scott lunged after it into Sarasota Bay on Florida's Gulf Coast.
Trust me.
I trust you.
Just not with the ring, which Scott managed to fish out of the drink because the box was slow to sink. Susie Tucker couldn't stop laughing. Scott climbed back aboard the boat, got down on bended knee, and finished what he'd started, though soaking wet. She said yes. He then put a ring on it and they kissed. Fans clamored to see the ring. The bride-to-be wrote, I cannot wait to marry my best friend, a.k.a. the smoothest guy around. He may not have felt so smooth in the immediate aftermath.
I love you.
Dude, how wrong could that have possibly gone?
Oh, if it really went wrong, the ring would have ended up where the Titanic did.
Any excuse to play this will do.
Yeah, admit it. We did this story just to... Just to play this.
To have a reason. Yeah, so you got to see the video. It's funny. I mean, it's sad. I mean, because, you know, wedding rings, engagement rings cost a lot of money. And this guy, he kneels down on the front of this little boat, and the inevitable happens. The box falls out of his hand and falls into the water. And do you see how fast this guy is to get off that boat?
No hesitation.
And he goes backward. You know, he just... immediately into the water. Here it comes. Yeah. All right. And he gets it. He gets the ring. This is one of the most amazing things about this story, because it's still in the box. If the ring had been out of the box, that would have been it. Game over, man.
Game over.
Oh,
game
think
over,
of this,
man. It's game over.
Think of the story that this couple will be able to tell 50 years from now about that ring. So anyway, see the video. It's on the show Twitter feed at P Madrid Show. I think you'll like it. Let's go to Barbara now in Massachusetts. Hi, Barbara.
Hi, Patrick. I'm going to be discreet as possible because okay. I know you have little ones listening. But we have a four-year-old grandson, and I want to ask you, what do you think about a Catholic, traditional Catholic family, including Santa Claus and their Christmas celebration? My daughter is very devout like the rest of mm-hmm. us, and we don't know how to handle this.
Oh, I think it's great. I think it's great. I was raised with Santa Claus. We raised our children with Santa Claus. My children are raising their children with Santa Claus. I mean, obviously, he's a real historical figure, St. Nicholas, back in the 4th century. But as far as the custom goes of celebrating with Santa Claus as part of Christmas, I have nothing but positives to say about it. I've never really understood why some families say, well, we don't do that here because we're devout Catholics or we're whatever. I mean, they're not mutually incompatible. Jesus is the reason for the season, obviously. But the real Santa Claus, I mean, he was a real person, and he really did give gifts. So to perpetuate that actual, the saint, Catholic saint, he was a bishop, to perpetuate his memory in a thoroughly Christian way, celebrating the birth of Jesus, makes complete sense to me. So I'm very positive about it.
Yeah, well, I just want to tell you, if this is okay, this is what my thoughts were. Mm-hmm. I got the book on St. Nicholas, and our little boy is old enough to understand the true meaning, how, you know, there's a saint in heaven called, you know, St. Nicholas, and he lives in heaven now, and he, you know, he did some wonderful things helping the poor and everything and so forth, and but he's in heaven now, so now on the earth there's other people that...
Let me pause you, because we're entering the territory now where if parents are not muting the phone or the radio or shooing the little kids out of the room. I know where you're going with this, Barbara, but for the sake of not complicating matters for parents whose children might be listening, what if I just acknowledge the point that you're saying without you saying it?
Yeah.
Does that sound
okay.
good?
Okay. Oh yeah. Go ahead. Mm-hmm. I won't say anything else now.
Yeah. Just for the benefit of the little people. I know where you're going with this. So, for example, I remember when we went to wherever the department store was and Santa was there and you get to get a picture taken with Santa and all that. And my parents told me this is one of Santa's helpers. It's not the real Santa. You know he can't be in everywhere. He can't be in every store. So this man is helping Santa so that you can see a little bit of what Santa's like.
That's cute.
That's what you had in mind,
oh,
right?
Oh, that's beautiful. Thank you so much. I'm going to get off now so you can go on with your other callers. God bless you,
thank you,
Patrick.
Barbara.
And that's a very good answer. Thank you.
Thank
Bye-bye
you.
Now.
Nice chatting with you. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Noel now in San Francisco. Hi, Noel.
Hi, Patrick. Good morning.
Good morning. Welcome.
Yeah, just in reference to your earlier caller who is discerning between the Mormon religion and the Catholic faith. I do have a very mm-hmm. close Mormon friend, and I've known him for 40 years. And the thing about him is he was Catholic, and then when we were in high school, he converted to Mormonism. And one of the ideas I presented to him as of late is that with the Mormon religion, there's a singular person who is a witness to the faith, which is, Joseph Smith mm-hmm. and all of the congregation of the Mormon Church who are paying witness, as you said earlier. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the Catholic faith, there's a string of witnesses across centuries, including saints, the Virgin Mary, people have been martyred in the first century, mm-hmm. third century. And so people who've been testifying to the faith, either who died, some of them are incorruptible, present-day saints like my grandmother, my mother.
No, if I can interrupt you, I'm very familiar with all of this. So did you have a question about this or something?
Oh, no, I was just commenting that to add to what could add to his ability to discern the faith is that the corroborative evidence with the Catholic faith is filled so much more than the Mormon faith. That's my end statement.
That makes sense. And I do agree with you that you have a 2,000-year a history of those who witnessed to the truth of the Catholic faith going back to the earliest days. That's a very good point. Yeah.
Have a great day, Patrick.
Thank you. Appreciate that. That reminds me, and thanks for the call, Noel. I remember now the name of the book that I was about to tell the gentleman from a little while ago, the one who's an agnostic but raised Mormon and is now pondering becoming Catholic. It's a new book that just came out, published by Ignatius Press. It's called From the Susquehanna to the Tiber, a memoir of conversion from Mormonism to the Catholic Church. I wish they. It says to the Roman Catholic Church. It's so unnecessary to put the word Roman. I wish they hadn't done that. But in any case, that's the subtitle: A Memoir of Conversion from Mormonism to the Catholic Church. Although I haven't read the book yet, I have interacted briefly on Twitter with the author. His name is Jeremy Christensen, and I have received, much to my delight, I received from Ignatius Press a review copy of the book. So I'm very much looking forward to reading it, which I will be doing soon. Here's a description from the book cover. Jeremy Christensen offers an intimate account of life as a faithful, sometimes stumbling member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Growing up in a small Mormon town, he served as a Mormon missionary for 2 years in Argentina, raised a young family in the Mormon Church, and served in Mormon leadership positions. But as he grew older, he became unsettled about the principles of his faith, setting him on a long search for God and for truth that would ultimately lead to the Catholic Church. Based on detailed personal journals, this vivid book explores the highly unique approach to religious epistemology found in Mormonism. Although the faith theoretically encourages the use of reason, Mormons' beliefs and in practice are rooted chiefly in emotion. Christensen offers singular insight into life within this system, with all of its beauties and its limits. Thanks to the subtle workings of Providence, Christensen discovered Catholicism through the ancient writings of the Church Fathers, who revealed a robust Christian intellectual tradition, and through the mystery, and through the mystical glory of her liturgy. So check it out. We have a link to that book for you on the show Twitter feed at P Madrid Show. So if you're LDS and you're listening to the program and you're thinking about the Catholic Church and you'd like to know what his journey was like, that book will tell you. Let's go now to Matt in Green Bay. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning, Patrick. I'm going to be giving my godson a little Lego confessional set for Christmas because he's going to be having his first confession in February. And, you know, my sister, his mom, said he's kind of nervous about it. So I figured, you know, kind of give him a toy to practice might calm his nerves a little bit. But I'm going to be giving it at Christmas, and I have some other, you know, Pentecostal-leaning family members, and even like health and welfare-type-leaning family members. Okay. And I'm worried that they're going to ask me, you know, well, why do you, you know, Catholics don't even really need to go to a priest. I'm not sure if they'll bring it up, but I want to be prepared if they do. So I've heard you, and you can go through a couple of your initial responses if you want, but I kind of want to take it to the next step. Because I've heard you kind of quote, you know, like Matthew 16 and 18, chapters 8, 16, 18, where some of that authority is given to the apostles. One question on like Matthew 18, what if they say that, you know, is Jesus necessarily talking to the apostles, or is he talking to like all of his disciples? Because I know the chapter starts with the word disciples, so it's kind of like a question between apostles and disciples. What if they kind of say, well, he wasn't talking specifically to the apostles, it's kind of like the church as a whole, you know, including us, can kind of, you know, forgive each other's sins, and God will do that directly as well. Do you have any kind of response to that?
Sure. So you're talking about Matthew 18:18, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, and this is one of the things you have to take care of, because we do see both disciples and apostles mentioned. And so part of it is going to be, what is the text of the scripture passage itself say, but in addition to that, we also have to understand, how did the early church understand this, and to what was their understanding of this meaning here? So it's true, in Matthew 18, we see the beginning in verse 15 where it talks about, if your brother sins against you, go and tell him his fault. And at the very first verse, we see the disciples mentioned. Then we see in verse 21, Peter came up and said to him, Lord, how often shall my brother sin against me and I forgive him? Okay, so we do begin to see kind of a focus on the apostles there. But the context of Matthew 18, beginning in verse 15, doesn't say specifically the 12 apostles. it's implied, but it's not specifically said there. But even this passage is not really the major passage for the sacrament of confession or reconciliation. That's found in John chapter 20. And let me just read that to you. So we are in verse 19. On the evening of that day, the first day of the week, the doors being shut where the disciples were for fear of the Jews, Jesus came and stood among them and said to them, "Peace be with you." When he had said this, he showed them his hands and his side. Then the disciples were glad when they saw the Lord. And Jesus said to them again, "Peace be with you. As the Father has sent me, even so I send you." And when he said this, he breathed on them and said to them, "Receive the Holy Spirit. If you forgive the sins of any, they are forgiven. If you retain the sins of any, they are retained." Now Thomas, one of the 12, called the twin, was not with them when Jesus came. So the other disciples, and this is where it gets into the issue of, if I can touch his wounds, then I'll know that he really rose from the dead. So here again in context, we see the word disciples that are mentioned. But when you look at the explanations or descriptions of the upper room, for example, in Acts chapter 2, we see that the 12 apostles minus Judas were there. Our Lady was there. Mm-hmm. And presumably there were some other disciples who were there as well. We're not told, but we do know that this is where the apostles were based. They were staying there for fear of the Jews. So we know that the apostles themselves, minus Judas, and in this case, minus Thomas, were there. And so this authority to bind and loose was given to them by Jesus, but it may well have also been given by Jesus to some of these other close disciples who were not apostles. They were disciples, but not among the 12. So that being the case doesn't in any way detract from the fact that Jesus gave them this authority to forgive sins. Mm-hmm. That's the key to this passage. I'll stop there.
Yeah.
Any question about that?
No, I think that helps. I didn't have John chapter 20 in my mind because that is a little bit more clear. I've listened to some of your responses. I know I want to clearly show the authority piece, you know, to them if it mm-hmm. goes down that route. So I'll definitely use that. The only other piece too, I know you've kind of mentioned that when Jesus heals a leper, I believe he tells him to go and show the priest that he's clean.
Right. Right.
As kind of a, almost like a, should I say that's almost like a foreshadow of confession, because he did that mainly because of the Mosaic law, right? Not necessarily confession, but
right.
Is it more
right.
kind of like a shadow? Is that correct, I guess?
That's one way to put it. I would classify it as a parallel. There's an analogous okay. parallel yeah. here. And I see the parallel like this. So you are, and this, by the way, is in Mark chapter 1. So mm-hmm. you, the sinner, are the equivalent of the leper. You, the sinner, cry out for forgiveness like the leper cried out for Jesus. I know that if you want to heal me, you can heal me. The leprosy is analogous to the sin. And when you ask for forgiveness, God indeed forgives you, just as Jesus healed the man on the spot. But because of the corporate dimension of sin and how our sin, as St. Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 12, our sin affects the body of Christ, of which we are a members. The extra step that Jesus gave to this man was, now go show yourself to the priest. And the reason for that was so that the priest could formally vouchsafe, he could certify that, yes, indeed, this man had been cured, because otherwise he wouldn't be allowed back into the community because of the contagion problem. So in a similar way, analogously, Jesus gives this authority to the first priests, to the apostles, so that they can grant absolution in his name. In fact, St. Paul talks about this in 2 Corinthians chapter 5. So he says, "No, if anyone is in Christ, he is a new creation." This is verse 17. "The old has passed away, and behold, the new has come. All this is from God, who through Christ reconciled us to himself and gave us the ministry of reconciliation." Now, notice the pronouns that he uses here. He says he's given to us the ministry of reconciliation. That is, in Christ, God was reconciling the world to himself, not counting their trespasses against them, and entrusting to us the message of reconciliation. So we are ambassadors for Christ, God making his appeal through us, we beseech you on behalf of Christ to be reconciled to God. So notice the we, us, and that's counterposed with the you. So it's further strength to the understanding of this passage that St. Paul was not saying like, hey, all of us as a group, all of us Christians as a group have been given this ministry of reconciliation. He's referring to the cadre of the apostles, and he himself was not one of the 12, obviously, but those to whom, as he says, this has been entrusted. So this is why then he says, we beseech you to be reconciled to God. How? Through this appeal that God is making to you through us and has entrusted to us the message of reconciliation. So we all share in that message. You know, we all can talk about the message of reconciliation that has been entrusted to all of us, but the ministry of reconciliation was entrusted to those first priests, those first bishops. You see?
Perfect. Okay. Thanks a lot, Patrick. So this, you touched on a couple of new things that you didn't. I know there's a confession episode, I think, around the 13th of November that I listened to, too. And you just added a couple things. So I'll go back, listen to that one, re-listen to this one, and hopefully some conversations can start in my family. I know when the sacraments come up, hopefully there'll be an opportunity to at least bring it up, right? And,
yeah.
And I'll be able to say a few things. So
one thing you can do, Matt, is get over to the Catholic Answers website, catholic.com, and you can get their tract. They actually have several on the biblical basis of confession. And it's free if you get the PDF version of it. Maybe pass that around to your friends and your family. I'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back. Not much time left. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Tori now in Des Moines, Iowa. Hi, Tori.
Hi, Patrick. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Got a question on natural family planning.
Sure.
And from my understanding, the teaching is if you don't have a grave reason to avoid, then you shouldn't. Mm-hmm. And that's always just been a little subjective to me. So like if you are just feeling like you need a break in a little space out of your kids, or if one of your spouse feels done having children, describe what grave means?
Sure. Well, yeah, this is one of those issues that is, I think, maybe somewhat misunderstood. And I'm going to go back and take a look at Humanae Vitae, because I want to make sure I have the correct terminology here. So it says, let's see. The Magisterium's reply to the question about using NFP, this is in section 6 of Humanae Vitae. It says, consequently, now that we have sifted carefully the evidence sent to us and intently studied the whole matter as well as prayed constantly to God, we, by virtue of the mandate entrusted to us by Christ, intend to give our reply to the series of grave questions. The reason I'm saying this is because the term grave in relation to the reasons that a couple might have for employing natural family planning does not appear in the text, the English text of Humanae Vitae. And I think that the difficulty here is where people think that you have to have a grave reason, meaning it's got to be some extreme situation, and that's not the church's teaching on this issue. So rather, I would say a significant or serious or an important reason, and that could be your mental health, your emotional health. That could be finances. That could be, we live right now in a difficult situation, and whether it's economic or some other problem, right now as a couple, we don't think this is the right time to conceive a child. You have that right. It doesn't have to be a grave reason, like okay, we're in Ukraine and people are bombing us. That's a grave reason. But it doesn't have to rise to that level of gravity for you to have okay, a sufficient reason. Now, if I can go in the other direction, I would say there is a point at which you would not really have a sufficient reason if it's like, well, I just want to keep my figure, or I just want to, you know, if it was some sort of maybe frivolous reason or non-essential reason, then I'd say you might not have a sufficiently important reason. But if you've reached the point, or you and your husband have reached the point where you say, right now, with everything else going on, it just wouldn't be a good idea for us to have another child, that's sufficient. You know, you have your emotional, mental, physical reasons, and the Lord understands that.
Okay, that makes sense. Thank you so much. I appreciate your answer.
You're welcome. You're most welcome. Thank you. Appreciate that. Let's go now to Diane in Minnesota. Hi, Diane.
Hi, Patrick. Question. I have a situation where my husband had passed away. And so there's a 3.5-year-old. And just wondering if you've got a book suggestion, or if you've got the words to, explaining to my daughter, explaining with regards to death and purgatory and heaven and such, if you've got suggestions, and you know that not being able to see him anymore.
Yeah, I can. I don't even like to imagine having to explain this to a child. I've never been in that situation, and I suppose inevitably these things happen. Well, I don't know of a book per se, but I do know of an organization that can help you, or at least make some recommendations for you. And that would be Holy Heroes. And their website is holyheroes.com. Now, I don't know if they have anything in their product line that deals with this, but they would know. If there is such a resource, they would know. And they would be happy to help you.
Well, when I first started listening to Relevant Radio a number of years ago, I know there was a priest that was talking to someone with regards to that, and I was thinking that there was a book, and I should have written it down, I guess.
If you find out, let me know.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much, Patrick.
You're welcome. I wish I had something snappy off the top of my head, but this is another example where I don't know. So let's see. Let's go to Juan now in Covina, California. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Patrick. Thank you for taking my call. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Yeah, okay. I just have a quick question for you. I pray the rosary every day. And I know at the beginning of the rosary, they always say for you to say your intention. And I want to know exactly what an intention means.
Well, it simply means, what are you asking the Lord in praying this rosary? Are you praying this rosary for the intention of maybe a loved one in purgatory to get out of purgatory and go to heaven, or all the souls in purgatory? Are you praying this rosary for those members of your family or people you know who are going through a difficult time? Are you praying the rosary as a form of penance for past sins in your life? Or are you doing it for all of the above? There's no limit to the number of intentions you can have when you pray the rosary, or any prayer for that matter. You can have as many intentions as you want. You could have one intention. You could have one person in mind. You could have a million people in mind. So there's no limit to it. But the word intention here refers to, what is it that you are offering to the Lord this rosary for? It can be anything.
Okay. Because my sister just passed away, so I'm, in Mexico we say the novenario, which I'm sure you've heard of.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the priest told me to say my intention, and my intention is this rosary is, for the intention of the
repose of the soul
to rest in
of your
peace
sister
and to go to heaven.
Exactly. That's exactly it. I apologize. I'm out of time, but you nailed it. That's exactly what your intention would be, if that's what you want it to be. Thank you. All great calls, as per usual. I look forward to being with you again tomorrow. Same Pat time, same Pat channel. You have a 21-hour break, and then we'll get back to it. I'll pray for you. Please pray for me. God bless you.